This is a Forwardly podcast.
Oh, hey, everybody, it's Colin.
Hi, it's Cadence. You know what I was thinking the other day? How convenient it is that of all of our siblings, we both have K names.
I know. I was going to say, I thought that the other day. Listeners, I don't want you to think that we're one of those families that has, like, you know, Kylie.
Like a Kardashian like situation.
Yeah, or like any kind of all the K names. We have brothers and sisters, and they have different letters than their names, okay?
Yeah.
Only Cadence and I have names that start with K.
Yeah, I was just like, that's kind of convenient for what we're doing. But anyway.
Anyway, we, you know, we're just giving you a little mini-sode today, just a little bonus episode, because we were, so far in this season, we've done Bolero, Deep Blue Sea, we've done Troll 2, we've done Glitter, Face Off, Battlefield Earth. I think I'm missing one. I think there's one more.
Nope, that's it.
But, you know, we're just like kind of talking about it, trying to figure out, you know, who pulled the trigger on these movies? Who said that these movies were good? Who
so many
in Hollywood
pulled.
Said, hey, these are really good ideas? Bolero is my number one, who honestly thought Bolero should get made, but I digress. Anyway, we were talking about it, and so we started looking up some stuff online, and there's just
I don't know if you're one of these people, but I'm one of these people that, like, I have to research pretty much everything I watch, no matter what it is.
You love it. She researches everything.
I want to
know everything about every movie, about the actors, their backgrounds, the set designers, their kids' names, where they went to school. Mm-hmm. You love it.
I need full context.
Full context for how these movies got made.
Just becomes like a really well-rounded experience when I know all of the things there is to know. So that's exactly what I did for all of these movies so far. I have culled the internet for the best bits of trivia about all the movies we've done thus far. And Colin, these are all news to him. I've saved the best bits.
Do not know
to
them.
Share with
do
Colin.
Not know them, because I, unlike Cadence, do not look anything up ever.
Well,
I experienced
if you don't
the movie
understand
a
movie, then why would you want to know right. more about it?
That movie was good. Bye. Case closed. All right, I'm ready to hear some of these. Let's go.
All right, so we're going to go in sequential order what we've covered so far. So, of course, first is Bolero. We're starting
Bolero,
with that.
Bolero, the most uncomfortable at the beginning.
So, okay, the first thing I'm going to start with is it's like offensive, but I thought it was worth sharing because it's so, it's like a peek into a different time that I just can't even wrap my brain around. So Olivia Diabo, she played the little gypsy girl. I couldn't remember. What's her name again?
Paloma.
Paloma. So she was 14 in real life.
No way.
Yes. And she is nude several times
in
this movie.
Oh my God. Because we were talking about it and that is
full nude.
So
full
awful.
Nude.
Oh my God.
So it gets worse. Okay. So she said that she physically matured when she was 13. And when John Derek wanted to hire her, he didn't believe her. He asked her to get breast implants.
What?
Oh at age
you're just starting
14.
This off real awkward. You're starting this off on a real dark note.
I know, that's what I'm saying. Not all the trivia is like this, but I had to share it because I thought it was batshit.
That is so gross. That should be illegal. You could not have a naked 14-year-old on any TV or movie.
Yes,
ever.
And wait. He didn't. He asked her to get breast implants. She's like, trust me, I hit puberty. He made her take her clothes off on set. And the first time he saw her real boobs, he was like, okay, we're good. You don't need to.
That is disgusting.
Isn't that
horrible?
That is horrible?
Wildly disgusting.
Who was advocating for this child? I mean, Bo Derek was his wife. They were both producers of this film. And Bo Derek wasn't like, hey, John,
this
she's
seems a, little
a
weird.
Child.
She's a child. And she had no point in the story either, except for being kind of just there. It's not like she had a pivotal role. Not
no,
she made
she
the
really
movie.
Didn't.
She really could have been cut out of the movie. All she did was lead him to the guy.
She was just the connector.
Yeah.
She connected the dots. Yeah, it was wild. So anyway, that's
okay,
really the only one that's truly fucked up.
Get to set it off on a nice, happy tone.
But that one just blew my mind. It blew my
so
mind
gross.
That anybody thought that was
yes.
okay. It blew my mind that
well, I remember
nobody
talking
was there
about
to advocate.
It, and I was like, why? I was like, she has to be 18 if she's doing this on TV.
Right.
Ugh. No,
she wasn't.
I hate it even more.
Yeah. So here's another one. Producer Menem Golan would send Bo and John Derek memos about how to make the film more erotic.
Oh, jeez. They obviously didn't get those memos. So they got lost somewhere.
They would just send memos back that said, this film is erotic enough.
They were right. It really was. Wait, who was sending it to him? Is that the director?
The producer was sending, because Bo and John Derek are married, and yeah. John was the director, Bo was the star, and Bo was also a producer. So they would send notes being like, okay, you got to pump up the erotic factor.
Okay, pump it up. And she's like, okay, I'm thinking ghost sheet over my head, helmet wearing. I'm thinking like, what?
Wet water hair whipping.
Yes,
for
I'll
sure.
really sex it up. Okay?
Oh, and birds in a cage.
Birds on a cage. Oh, sure. I'll have them flutter all over his dick to get his impotence back. Yeah, that's
get his impotence back.
I mean, get rid of his impotence. Get his penis working again. Because you guys, that's what she did. I don't know if you remember. She released a bunch of birds onto his penis. I don't know how to explain
it. Oh, I've definitely implemented that into my sex life. I have a lot of birds around the house these days.
So weird.
So, we also had a couple conversations about where the name Bolero had even come from, why they chose it, because it was so, there was no mention of that at all in the
movie. Yeah, we had like looked it up what it was, because it was like a Spanish style dance where they wear this specific type of jacket, which I think is the dance is Bolero or the jacket
is
Bolero.
But the reason they named the movie Bolero was two things. It's so convoluted. One was that the first was part of the name of Bo Derek, Bo.
Oh, clever.
And then she had her first major sex scene and become a sex symbol in the movie 10.
Yeah, that's where she had the braids on the beach mm-hmm. running.
And that had been choreographed to the score of the classical music piece Bolero by Maurice Ravel.
Interesting.
So okay. They were just, you know, cutting and pasting some stuff
so
together.
So many layers to that Bolero movie. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, she became famous with 10. That's how I knew her. I just knew the dreadlock running on the beach. But I always thought it was the girl from Splash.
Right.
What's her name?
Oh, yeah. Daryl Hannah.
Daryl Hannah. I always got them confused. But yeah,
both
okay.
beautiful well, blondes.
Good name.
And then there was this whole other sort of subplot. It's kind of complicated, but essentially the producers just wanted to get as much distance from this movie as humanly possible. The studio wanted nothing to do with it. And Bo Derek said the producers were so disappointed with the film, they threatened to take away the Derek's family ranch in a ploy to distance themselves from the controversy.
What? They can't do that. Just come and take your home because they're so mad at the movie.
They're like, listen.
Listen, we do
a
not.
A lot of distance.
I would definitely be on that producer's side. I'm going to distance myself as much as I possibly can from this awfulness. But you can't take the damn house.
It was really funny. It was just like everybody really bought into it. Everybody went full force. They didn't release it as the only, at this point, there was no NC-17. So because it was more than an R rating, the only other option was to be rated X. And they didn't want that because that would be, they in their minds, like pornography.
It's like Showgirls. Showgirls was the first rated NC-17, I think, right? Or rated
Showgirls
X.
Showgirls paved the way for so many things. It was so progressive. And so they opted to release it just without a rating. That was how they got around that. And everyone hated it.
Movie companies
everyone
just
said
do
it
that.
Was unwatchable.
Can movie companies just be like, you know what? We're just not going to give it a rating. And we'll do what we'll get away with it, whatever we want. You know what? We just don't have to give it a rating.
And John Derek was just like, you know what? He wouldn't let anybody see sneak previews because everyone that had seen it so far thought it was so bad. So he was like, you know what? I made the movie I wanted to make, and I'm happy to release it the way I want to release it, when I want to release it, and I'm not going to show anybody beforehand.
I mean,
so, you know, he stands by it.
Good for you, John. Good for you. You made a shit movie that everyone hated, but you know what? You made a movie.
I cannot wait to watch the next movie that we had. Ghost Can't Do It.
Oh, Ghost Can't Do It.
Which is also him and Bo Derek.
Yes,
that's
you guys,
on the list, you guys.
It's really good. She tries to find a host for her dead husband, I think. It's mm-hmm. really, I think that's what it is.
Yes, it's going to be amazing. So I also just wanted to read some amazing clips. The New York Times wrote a review in 1984 when Bolero came out, and it was so entertaining. So there are a couple of things that made me laugh. It said, most of Bo Derek's antics look distinctly chaste. And when she appears au naturel to do something other people might do clothed, riding a horse, for instance, the effect is less erotic than inappropriate. For some reason, the movie's sex scenes, which are relatively few, have been directed as slapstick. The The chief exception is a final, more graphic tryst that takes place in the clouds with a purple neon sign behind Miss Derek reading Ecstasy.
I know. We said at the very beginning, this movie was not erotic. It was uncomfortable. Her riding a horse naked, it wasn't like sexy. It was like, ow. I can just only imagine little horse hairs getting up in your vajaj. Scraping it around
in
her.
I know, I could not.
It was like, no, that seems uncomfortable and uncomfortable for the viewer. Oh, and I'm sorry, when she spit in his ear and then licked it out.
Oh, erotic. Don't remind me. There are some things I blocked out of that.
Erotic, Bo Derek. Good choice.
So the other thing that made me laugh from this review is they're talking about John Derek having also written the screenplay. And so he says, but he has directed her to remain insufferably coy, so as that the trysts are played for awkward laughs, and each love scene is prefaced by an orgy of nail-biting, hair-tossing, and whinnying. In one memorable scene, Miss Derek greets her bullfighter lover with a sheet covering her from head to toe, crowned with a Prussian helmet. She is dressed as a ghost, and she explains to him, I thought you would be as scared to death as I am.
That's what I just said. Like, they're leaving memos to each other, like, make it more erotic. And she's like, be a ghost. Be a ghost with a helmet on. That will definitely kick up the eroticism of this movie.
So anyway, that was just some of the highlights. They were just like, it was so uncomfortable and awkward. And I liked that they were not being like brutal, but they're just like, listen, none of this works. I'm sorry to tell you.
They got in the New York Times. Valero got in the New York Times. So good for them.
All right. So moving on. Next is Deep Blue Sea.
Mm-hmm. Give me the facts. Are you excited? Please tell me that you looked up what the hell was going on with LL Cool J and the bird.
Tell me you got some backstory. This is my favorite. This is probably my favorite bit of trivia, and I'm just going to skip right to it since you brought it up about the bird. Okay.
Bird, your tongue's nasty.
All right. So here we go.
Okay. Ready?
This is the bird fact.
Okay. Bird fact. Go.
There wasn't a huge budget for the movie, and director Rennie Harlan stated in the DVD commentary, there was lots of discussion about should we have the parrot, should we not have the parrot.
So we opted. Could you imagine having board meetings? Do we put in the bird or do we not? What do we do with the bird? How do we make it relevant to the story?
Okay, so should we have the parrot, should we not have the parrot? So we opted to have the bird, mm-hmm. but we couldn't afford a Hollywood parrot.
Oh no, there's Hollywood parrots?
A parrot that's fully trained and comes with its professional trainers and does tricks and speaks on cue and so on. So we decided to go with a parrot from Mexico City.
Oh no, they just kidnapped a parrot from Mexico City and put it in a movie.
The production actually used two parrots. One that was good at flying and another one that was adept at sitting on LL Cool J's shoulder.
So ridiculous. Why would you get a parrot from Mexico City? Like, why go through all that trouble to have the parrot in the movie? There was no need for it. It was completely the movie would have been just the same without the bird.
You could have easily written that out. Like, well, then the fact
Cool J
that there
wouldn't
was
have
even
a reason he wouldn't have a reason to be vengeful if bird didn't die. So maybe it's a driving character force for him.
You're so right. That was like his the beating heart of his character was Bird.
Because once Bird got eaten by that shark, that's when LL Cool J really stepped up and started blowing up things and stabbing things and hitting them with pans. So it's kind of like a facilitator.
It totally was. It was a catalyst for him. So, you know, Bird served a purpose, even if it was a Mexico City bird.
R.I.P. Bird. You're not a Hollywood bird, but you're still a bird in my heart.
He'll do. All right, so for one scene, Thomas Jane, who plays Carter Blake, had to swim alongside a real-life shark, but he was only allowed to do this shoot once he had completed all of his other scenes, which I
thought... Oh my God, because they're like, just in case anything happens, we've got him for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
So if a shark bites off your arm, it's like, well, at least we have him for the rest of the movie.
I thought that was so rude.
So rude. If I was him, I would look at my contract.
Listen,
what kind of
shark
was
it? You might die, but we're gonna have you for the rest of the movie. That's all that matters. And we'll have your death on tape. So win-win.
Win-win. When did he ever have to swim like a shark? All those sharks were, none of them were real. It was all CGI. And when he was like surfing on the back of it, it was clearly like a plastic shark across the water.
Definitely not real.
When was there a real shark?
I don't know. There is a scene where he's kind of like in the same general vicinity as the shark. And that's the thing. It was like a really brief scene. And he said it was traumatizing to have to do it. Like, he has a fear of sharks. And so anyway, I felt like you could have gotten away without that.
Right? I don't feel like there was any need for that at all because none of the sharks in the movie were real. He's not a real shark wrangler. It doesn't make sense.
Right.
Was it a Hollywood shark, though? Or was it one of those?
Could you imagine was it those a Hollywood Mediterranean shark with, like, sharks? Sunglasses?
I know. He's like, hey, here to swim.
I don't want to do this again. I don't know if anybody told you this.
You find me in my dressing room. I'm a Hollywood shark. And I know a Hollywood parrot.
So this was one of those things that I guess once you're part of the movie, like, you know all of the motivations for mm-hmm. the characters and things mm-hmm. that happened that just the layperson watching doesn't know. So this was something that I thought was really interesting. So in the beginning, when that shark goes to the catamaran, you know, the opening scene.
The very beginning Jaws ripoff scene where he is going to kill the high schoolers having a sex on a catamaran in the middle of the ocean.
Mm-hmm. So that was a Gen 1 Mako. Okay. That wasn't a Gen 2.
That was, I know, you know why? It didn't swim backwards. It didn't turn off all the security cameras on that catamaran.
Didn't turn off all the lights.
It didn't turn off all the lights in sequence. That's why I knew.
So the Gen 1 Mako that escaped threatened the catamaran and then was rounded up again in case, in the opening sequence, it wasn't just a chance escapee. It was scouting the area to confirm that the nearby waters were suitable for all three super Makos to inhabit.
Oh, my God.
Not too warm or cold. Oh, my God.
Whoever's
writing this. No rival predators to fear and plenty of prey. It attacked the boat to test its own hunting abilities, verifying that they'd be able to survive on their own once humans weren't supplying them with food anymore.
Where did you get this? Is this a fan theory off Craigslist? That is not a real thing. Is that what the producer said? They really put that much energy behind it? No one was thinking that. Oh, God, that is ridiculous. So it actually is smarter, you know, if it's scouting out food, predators, making sure the waters are okay.
I mean, and that was just a Gen 1.
That was just a Gen 1. Think about what those Gen 2 guys did. Now you know why Bird got killed. Those Gen 2s are smart. Smarter, I should say.
Smarter. This made me laugh a little bit because I guess the visual effects team, they said, notably during the infamous scene of the shark grabbing Samuel L. Jackson, the shark itself looks too rubbery, and the way it grabs him seems to defy all known physics. Even the visual effects team at Hammerhead Production admitted that it had some flaws.
You think? He was standing in front of a tiny, like, 2-foot hole, and a giant shark comes and bends in half, eats him, and drags him down. What the fuck's the word?
Defies
all, like, logic. Like, sharks don't move like that. They don't. But it is the scene making of the movie. Or that's making, you know what I mean.
What are you trying to say, bud?
I don't know. I'm having a hard time. What are you trying to say, bud? I was saying that was the scene that made the movie. That's what I'm trying to say.
Oh, for sure.
It's what caught your eye. That's what got, you got stuck on it. You just, once you saw that scene, you were hooked on Deep Blue Sea.
Oh, that was the gateway drug for me.
DPS was the gateway drug. It was like your dust.
I guess. I must be smoking dust, Daddy.
I must be smoking dust, Daddy, because I just saw DPS for the first time.
So this is kind of a small fact on the tail end of that. So I guess the rumor was around the time that this movie was made that Samuel L. Jackson wasn't having a good time filming the movie. So they conceived of that death halfway through because he just wanted to be off the movie. But that actually wasn't the case at all. He had originally been offered the role of Preacher, played by LL Cool J. But he didn't like the idea of being, like, playing a chef, so he turned it down.
He didn't want to play along with the Mexican parrot either. He's like, nope, I'm only doing that job if you get me a Hollywood parrot. Listen,
I'm Samuel L. Jackson. Hollywood parrots are part of my contract.
No.
And so, basically, Renny Harlin wrote the role of Russell Franklin for him, and he tells him, like, you're going to be the richest man in the world, you're going to have the greatest scene in the movie, it's going to be a shock to everyone, and immediately Samuel L. Jackson was like, yep, I'm sold, you got me.
But then they just kill him off. I can't believe that he allowed them to kill his character off. Sorry, spoilers. Spoiler alert. Samuel dies. Samuel gets picked out of the laboratory real quick by a shark. A Mako shark. Gen 2.
Gen 2.
Pops through the hole, flops over, grabs him, takes him under.
This is another thing connected to the opening scene with the catamaran. During the opening scene, it's implied that the shark becomes more aggressive in attacking the boat of teenagers because of the blood-like wine that spilled off the boat.
Oh, my God.
But why would a shark mistake the smell of wine for blood? until you realize that it's thanks to the shark's enhanced brain that it's ignoring instincts of smell and is relying on things like assumptions, just
where
like
are
a
you
human would.
Cadence, where are you getting this? This is some guy in his parents' basement writing fan fiction for Deep Blue Sea. That is way too thought out. We're not dealing with the film here, you guys. It was sharks. It was sharks that attack people. It's like not this deep meaning. Like no one's sitting there being like, oh, that makes sense. The sharks understand the wine.
They're making assumptions just like a human brain.
I know. Come on. Who is writing
it's
this?
It's that protein complex.
Protein complex. Makes them very smart. Or they're just alcoholics now because they're so smart. And they're just
like wine. Okay. Well, where have we been missing out?
I know. I'm scouting the area for some old wine.
I love a Pinot Gris. That's like when they get real smart, they have like a wine club.
Well, you know, once you get smart and sophisticated, you always are part of a wine club. They're just always sipping shark wine.
So another deleted scene made it more obvious that Dr. Whitlock and Janice were in a relationship. And in one version, it revealed that Janice was pregnant and then she dies. But Rennie Harlan was like, it doesn't feel right to kill off a pregnant character. So they cut that out.
Well, yeah, it seems like just a frivolous thing to put in there at that point, because Janice like had maybe two lines, and Dr. Whitlock, he died real early. He was the first guy that got sassy smashed into the wall. He was the first one to die. So it just seems frivolous at that time. Anyway, yes, okay.
Here's one other thing about the depth of the choices that the sharks make that I think you're gonna really like. The scene where Franklin gets eaten was included to subvert expectations, but also because the sharks have clearly been observing human behavior. Even if they can't understand human speech, they figured out that people could cause the station to sink and how to herd them around, so they'd have to make it happen.
Oh my God.
So why couldn't they have killed Franklin when they did on purpose? If they could detect vibrations and erratic neural impulses, if people were panicking, and then realize that Franklin, who's we're getting out of this speech, was calming them down, then they may have deliberately taken him out before he could get everyone thinking.
Oh my God.
And potentially derail the Mako's gambit.
This is so stupid. They are really stretching the depth of this movie. It is so dumb. Also, the sharks haven't been observing human behavior. They don't have cameras. Do they have cameras inside?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Did you forget about the two-way movie screen?
I know.
Was sort of like glass that I really over-explained.
Right.
And it was just
The scientists are in there and they're like, does anyone notice these sharks have been watching us nonstop? They're just staring at us. Three
with
sharks.
With little notepads. Hey, little fins, writing
like
notes.
Sheila and Gary are sharks, our Gen 2. They've been staring at us for hours.
The sharks are like, no, just go about your business. You're fine.
Observing.
I'm just thinking about something.
We're just picking up your vibrations. Just be cool. Like, the sharks didn't observe. That's the only way the sharks could have observed the humans. And unless they were in that glass of aquarium the whole time, it just doesn't make any sense.
They could detect them vibrations.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
All right, the last thing of Deep Blue Sea that I just thought was a fun side note, the special effects team was headed by Walt Conti, who also did the snakes in Anaconda.
Yeah. That is good. Wow, what a connection there. He's really good at visual effects.
Really good job, bud.
Actually, it was the 90s. Or actually, Deep Blue Sea was early 2000s, right? But still, visual effects they came a long way since then.
He was evolving. And the thing is, they build, like, there's a lot of trivia around like the sharks, because they built these animatronic sharks and they spent like 8 months building these sharks. Like, it was a huge deal.
8 months building the sharks?
Yeah, because they had one, remember the giant one they have in the studio that bites off Dr. Whitlock's arm?
Oh yeah, when she's
like,
getting
that was a full
complex.
On yeah, a full on animatronic situation.
Oh, I couldn't tell. It looked real to me.
And they would they would challenge the audience to like pick out the fake sharks and which ones were CGI and which ones were animatronics.
Because
they were like, that's how good it is. You're not even going to tell the
difference.
You're not
going to know. Well, yeah, they obviously used a real one because they had training with a real one. So I wonder where that was in the movie.
I know. I'm really curious about where that scene was.
Because there was never a real shark in that movie. Not one time.
Yeah, it was not a lot. If it was, it was a real quick passing scene.
Maybe.
Real quick. All right, moving on.
Lay it on me.
Troll 2.
Troll 2, yes.
You ready?
I'm excited about Troll 2, Tivria.
There was a lot of good stuff. And some of the stuff we talked about, so I tried to pick new stuff that we weren't going to repeat. But one of my favorite things was the cast had a reunion, and they did a reunion Q&A as a panel. Mm-hmm. And the director mm-hmm. was so angry about the poor reception that he crashed this Q&A. And he was escorted out of the room because he started heckling the cast from the hallway, calling them liars and dogs.
What?
Isn't that crazy?
What? No one calls Holly a liar and a dog, number one. And I at the very end of the episode, if you guys didn't listen to Troll 2, at the very, very, very end, we put a little clip of the director being so defensive of his movie. He's just like, I don't make bad movies. I make good movies. I make movies. So angry because the people are basically asking him, like, how does it feel to make the best worst movie? And he's like, it's not the worst. It's scary. It's good. And I'm like, buddy, you just gotta take what people are saying and just kind of accept that you made a really, really amazingly bad movie.
Yeah, he had a hard time understanding why it didn't do well, and he was on board to make a sequel. He was already making plans. No one in the entire crew, like cast and crew, didn't, like, it was all an Italian crew, and the only person who could translate was the costume designer. And so
she's got a lot of blood on her, like, plate or his
exactly.
plate.
Exactly.
She's like, I'm designing like these troll costumes. I've got to interpret what this guy's saying, give these bizarre instructions.
And she can't be everywhere because she's a costume designer. So it's like, if she happened to be around, then she could translate what he wanted, you know, what he was trying to get from them. Otherwise, like they were just figuring it out.
Seems like that could have been a real easy fix. Just get a full-time translator. That seems like a pretty easy fix.
You would think, but there was a lot of things that could have been an easy fix that he chose not to.
Would I have done to have been on that panel that day asking them questions?
When Arnold turns into a tree.
Mm-hmm. I still want to know what happens to Arnold because it doesn't ever explain.
Well, he could still be standing there because it said his shoes were screwed into the base of the tree pot so he could remain stationary through the scene. And he had to stand inside this pot in his tree makeup for 14 hours.
Arnold, oh my God. That is amazing. That's dedication to the movie. Why 14 hours?
I don't know. I think maybe...
Did they film it all in one day? They just filmed the whole thing in one day.
It took 3 weeks to film this movie.
Did it really? 3 weeks?
Yes. Yes.
Oh my God. So
I think it was probably like, you know, well, they talk about that in other big budget movies too. It's like once you get into makeup, it takes such a long process that you just have to like power through for the whole day because there's no way to like take it off and then put it back on.
I'm just boggled because they only showed him like one time as a plant. Why would he have to stand there for 14 hours? I'm confused. Right. Did he know that he didn't have to?
And nothing about this movie had continuity. Nothing.
Nothing.
So if they were worried about
they showed him one
errors.
Time. Yeah, they showed him one time as a plant. That just doesn't make any sense.
It really, really, really was mind-boggling because I'm like, number one, it's not like they didn't make any mistakes. Just have him step out of the pot.
I know, right?
The bathroom. No one's going to notice.
Yeah, what are you... the dedication. He was so dedicated. He thought this movie was going to be so good. He was like, continuity!
Bless his heart. The American VHS cover features artwork consisting of a little boy with what appears to be a troll doll being chased down a dark corridor by a werewolf brandishing an axe. Mm-hmm. Neither the boy mm-hmm. nor the werewolf are in this film, and no one quite knows why this was the artwork.
I know, and if you look up Troll 2, there's like a couple different ones. There's one like big scary troll in the fog. Doesn't look like the trolls in the movie or anything. None of the artwork matches with what is in the movie.
Yeah, it's and they said that the trailer that the director released for Troll 2 consisted all of cut scenes that weren't even in the movie. He just strung together a bunch of scenes they shot that didn't get put in the movie and released it as a trailer.
He's keeping people on their toes. He does not want to give them a slice of the pie. They do not have any chance of knowing what's going on in this movie.
I mean, yeah, that's one way to do it. Absolutely going in blind. That makes sense.
I love going into movies blind.
According to cast members, the dance that Holly does in front of the mirror.
Oh, Holly, I love you.
It was ad-libbed because she had actual cheerleading experience.
I told you. I knew it. Those moves were too particular to be not practiced over and over. It was like workout moves. It wasn't dancing. It was like workout dancing.
It was very military cheerleading. Yes, for sure. It was a very unique style.
A very unique style. Holly, good job. Where's Holly now? What other movies has she been in?
I know this for a fact because the whole time I was watching Troll 2, I'm like, she looks really familiar to me and I can't quite figure out why. Because there's this really awful, terrible movie that got made by Mormons when I was like 19 called Singles Ward about Mormons going to a singles ward trying to find love in Utah.
She was in it?
She was the lead.
Oh my God.
She was the lead.
So her career took off, obviously, after Troll 2.
Yeah, it only took like 12 more years to get that part.
Remember when I thought everybody was a little girl from Waterworld?
Oh, everybody. If there was a little girl in the movie, she was the girl from Waterworld.
Every time I was like, is that the little girl from Waterworld? But she was never in anything else ever. But every movie I saw after Waterworld, I just thought the little girl from Waterworld was it.
I'm sorry, she was in Napoleon Dynamite.
I know, I was going to say she did make a debut in Napoleon Dynamite. But for some reason, I was on this kick for years where I was just like, hey, is it the little girl from the Waterworld? And they're like, no, not at all. Nope.
You just had like face blindness for kids. Like,
I did. All kids look the same.
This is something that I really enjoyed. So the costume designer, her name is Laura Gemser, and she was
She needs an Oscar for that. Those costumes were very spooky.
Okay, so listen. She was a part of softcore porn during the 70s and 80s.
Oh.
No one quite knows how she became the costume designer for this film.
The costume designer slash interpreter.
Interpreter, but listen. Her design for the costumes consisted of burlap sacks.
I definitely picked that up. Definitely.
And rubber Halloween masks.
Oh.
Did you catch that?
I did not get that at all from the very first scene when I said that they can't actually eat food because it's a plastic mask.
Some of them were reused in another movie. It's like Joe D'Amato's Ator Barbarian films. Don't know what those are,
I have no idea.
They were that good that they got reused.
The mask, the Troll 2 masks.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
And only one goblin had a mask modified to have a movable mouth.
Oh, which one? Because I did not see any that had a movable mouth. It was all plastic.
I don't know either, honestly. I didn't remember one moving, but maybe there was just... We were also enraptured by Gert, so yeah, all of our attention
She's my
very
favorite.
Focused.
Ugh, Gert, I love you, RIP girl.
And then... I just thought it was funny. This is like one little thing that's not that interesting, but it verifies that the witch's home was actually a former church, which we both were like, that's clearly a church. Oh, of course.
It was clearly a church. There's like a cross on it. It's like full stone in the middle. It's, yeah. Stained glass windows of Jesus.
There's lots of great, like, I mean, we covered a lot of them, but yeah, that movie was just like filmed in a really short amount of time. No one knew they were being cast in.
I can't believe they filmed it in 3 weeks.
It was, yeah, it was a wild ride. It was a real wild ride. But that's all of the trivia for Troll 2. And now we're going to move to Face Off.
Oh, God. I don't want to do Face Off trivia. I'm going to get angry again. I got so angry that whole time. That whole podcast, I just repeated myself on how angry I was.
If you need to take some time to get a drink,
Face Off was so awful. Okay.
Ready. Smoke a little cannabis, take an edible, just calm down. It's going to be fine. We're going to get through this. If you thought that there were aspects of Deep Blue Sea that were taken way too seriously,
I was blown away by that.
You have zero, zero, zero idea how much John Woo, Nicolas Cage, and John Travolta thought that they were making an absolute masterpiece.
Oh my God.
An absolute masterpiece.
I mean, they did. It was really, really good. But again, people liked it, though. I mean, in a way, 92% Rotten Tomatoes.
In a way, they did.
In a way, they did, man. People are still talking
about it. I mean, John Woo's a famous director, so he's obviously good at what he's doing.
I think John Travolta just thinks anything he makes is going to be really good, because we all know some of his choices.
Battlefield. I have a theory, and I don't know John Travolta well, or at all.
You don't know him well? I know him very well.
But I think he's like a narcissist that kind of takes himself very seriously. Like, I don't think he's capable of making fun of himself.
What gave you that idea? When he made Battlefield Earth and said it was the new Schindler's List, maybe?
There are some people who can sort of take themselves... You know, like, not take themselves seriously, make a joke, be like, yeah, ha ha. No, I just don't think he's capable of it. And my theory is actually, I think, partially proven by the first little tidbit of trivia I found. It said John Travolta asked the writers if they were making fun of him with the ridiculous chin line.
I thought that was like part of it, you know, like, because that was clearly a dig at his chin.
Right. And they had to explain to him. And this made me laugh because I just thought of a bunch of writers like calming him down.
JT,
like,
No,
it's not at all. We're not making fun of your chin at all. See, the thing is that Caster Troy is such a narcissist that he would just hate having anybody else's face. Like, this is 100% a Caster Troy issue, not a John Travolta chin issue.
We're not in control of Caster Troy's morals and is what he decides. It's his mind, not ours. They just fully put the blame on the actor, not the actor, the character, and his, what he would say. We're not writing this. He's writing it.
He brings the script. He's like, hey, guys, there's this line about a ridiculous chin. And I'm just curious if you think my chin is ridiculous. No, I don't think you have a ridiculous chin.
Not me.
Caster Troy thinks you have a ridiculous chin.
It's Caster Troy's fault. He's your arch nemesis.
So also something that I would pay so much money to watch is that originally Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone were going to play the lead roles.
That would have been amazing. I would have died. So good.
John Woo, when he was brought in to direct, he's the one that was like, nope, it's going to be John and Nick.
Stupid decision.
Like, you.
Stupid decision. Arnold and what's his name? What did you say?
Arnold and Sylvester Stallone.
Sylvester Stallone. That would have been amazing.
So good.
But Arnold Schwarzenegger's huge, though. Like, I know Sylvester Stallone's got a pretty good body and he's pretty big, Rocky. I get it.
The height difference is negligible.
The muscle mass is negligible.
Oh, that would have been so good watching Arnold try to be Sylvester and watching Sylvester trying to be Arnold. Oh, man.
Oh, well, good. They couldn't have done it either because Sylvester would have had to have his accent. You can't hide that accent, Arnold. There's no voice chip in the world can hide that accent.
The crew shot on Nicolas Cage's birthday. So also Nicolas Cage, I don't think, is also capable of making any jokes about himself.
Oh,
and he takes himself very seriously. He already like almost didn't sign on because he didn't want to play the villain. He was like, I don't agree with this. I don't want to be a villain. I'm only a hero.
And did so he really like, say that? Well, National Treasure, he was a hero.
So they're like, okay, here's the thing. Like, yes, you start out as the villain, but then you get to be the hero in the villain's body, so you're really the hero.
Oh, man, those writers, they manipulated that
crew. They're so good.
Really
they're
good.
Writers for a reason.
Got it. Okay. Did you know that Nicolas Cage kind of made a comeback with that Mandy movie? Did you ever see it?
Oh, Jed loves that movie.
Oh, it's so good. Loves I like it. It's a little, like, you know, out there, but he did a really good job. It's like, it was like kind of his comeback thing that he did. Everyone was so surprised to see Nicolas Cage.
We watched another movie about a... I cannot remember the name of it now, but it's him and he's like killing all these possessed things at like a Chuck E. Cheese, like not a real Chuck E. Cheese, but something like it.
So
Chuck
he's
Cheese.
Back in Nicolas Cage movies then.
Yes, it's just got made like last year.
Oh my God. That gave me an idea real quick.
He doesn't talk at all. He's in the whole movie and doesn't say one word.
Really?
Mm-hmm. He just fights these possessed animatronic animals.
I know what movie we have to do. That's a total B movie. It's so bad it's good. Wicker what? Man. He was
yes,
in Wicker
it's
Man.
On so many lists. It's
oh,
on so many lists.
We need to do
lists.
Wicker Man. I'm dying to see it because I know it's like on those. All I know is the scene where they put the bee cage on his head. The bees. Yeah.
I just saw a list of like the worst movies on Netflix or something. And that was on the list. And I keep seeing it pop up. And so, yeah, for sure. Okay. Mental note. We're going to do the Wicker Man. So here's another example of him being really uptight. The crew shot on Nicolas Cage's birthday and John Woo let Cage get really emotionally charged up for a scene and then surprised him with the birthday cake. And Nick Cage was like, so PO'd. He was like, do not do that to me again. Do not emotionally manipulate me like that again. You let me get all worked up for this scene. And then you surprise me with the birthday cake and I'm supposed to be happy.
Well, it is kind of a weird choice for John Woo to be like, let's do this. Like, maybe just give him the birthday cake when he's in a good mood off the set.
Yeah, like either before or after.
That's an easy problem. Just don't do it right in the middle of when he's doing a scene.
He did overcomplicate it. You're right. I'm putting too much
on
the
cage
for that one.
These writers, though, John Woo and these writers, a manipulation team 101. I love it.
Then Nicolas Cage also decided he didn't want to see any of the grotesque face makeup. So John Woo had to hide all the reflective surfaces.
Oh, God. I'm like,
come on, but just close your eyes.
Oh, my God. Just close your eyes. It's obviously makeup. They're not really taking your face skin off. It's okay, Nick Cage. Just chill.
Oh, my God. He's, yeah. So intense.
And that's the thing in the movie. They never actually, they only, and that is true because the only time you get a glimpse of his face when it's off is like not in a mirror. It's like the reflection of a bedpan or something, right?
That's true.
It's like a metal bedpan. So you kind of see the face makeup, but not really. So the audience didn't see it either. So you could have left that face makeup out. We definitely got the idea that your face was taken off. We don't need to see. We watched a 45-minute scene of them lasering off your face skin. We saw your skin in bandages. Mm-hmm. We get it.
It was clear.
You don't need to show us.
This is one of those things that's, so intense. The two main characters' blood types reflect their antagonistic nature. Sean Archer's blood type is O negative, the universal donor, reflecting Archer's role as a police officer dedicated to serving the community.
Oh, God.
Castor Troy's is AB positive, the universal recipient, someone who takes from society without giving anything back.
Oh, I picked up on that real easy. Real quick. That's so
stupid.
Those
were my notes. We just didn't have time to talk about it.
So stupid. So
dumb. Totally in my notes.
O negative. Oh, God. I don't even know my blood type.
I don't either.
Like, how do you find out your blood type? Do you call your doctor and be like, by the way, what's my blood type?
It's got to be like, yeah, if you have blood work done, like, it's got to be just
somewhere out there.
First thing on the list.
Yeah, right? Everyone, like, I just don't know. Because we had a conversation about blood types the other day, and I was like, I have no idea what my blood type is.
I should probably find out. It's probably helpful.
It's probably really rare. Probably only, like, a couple people have it.
You probably have just, like, they're actually going to discover a new blood type with yours. They're going to be like, we didn't think this even was possible, but... It's half wine, half blood.
it's Pinot Noir. That's what it is. It's PN blood. You have PN blood.
It's type PN.
It's type PN, Pinot Noir blood.
Oh my God, that's funny. Okay, so Joan Allen was John Woo's first choice for Eve. Mm-hmm. The studio wanted to go with someone younger and make her a stepmother, but Woo fought for her. I mean, I'm not saying they should have gone for someone younger. Should they have done a better hair situation?
Yeah,
for
should
sure.
They have done a better wardrobe change? Get the woman from Troll 2 to come in here and do some costumes for that woman. Put on a burlap sack because she was full head to toe every scene. They made her look very grandma-y.
This blew my mind. In early drafts of the script, Archer went to Castor's mother's place to hide out, and the writers wanted the mother to be played by... either Elizabeth Taylor or Jack Nicholson in drag.
No way.
What the fuck?
Jack Nicholson in drag. What?
Those are the options.
Elizabeth Taylor. Oh, I would have loved to see Liz Taylor be the mom. That would have been Nicolas Cage and Liz Taylor acting together. Would have been a dream come true.
Oh, over the top.
I don't know which one I would rather see more, Liz Taylor or Jack Nicholson in drag. I don't know. Tough choice.
Okay, this next
Speaking
one.
Speaking of, real quick, have you seen that show... with Zach Galifianakis,
what? Between Two Ferns?
No. It's the clown. It's the, like, a TV show. Baskets the clown.
Oh no.
Anyway, that guy Louis Anderson who did mm-hmm. Family Feud, he mm-hmm. plays his mom. So he is in drag, but he does mm-hmm. such a good job. I have to send you a picture. It's just Louis Anderson with like a blonde bob.
I love Louis Anderson so much.
And he plays the mom and it's so good. It's like, you just get caught up. You like kind of forget it's him because he does such a good job playing the mom. But anyway, side note.
I love him. He used to make a really funny cartoon when we were kids. Life with Louis. Do you remember that?
Yes, I remember Life with Louis.
Oh, I was obsessed with it.
Because he had that he was like that little kid with his voice.
Yes. It was so funny. Oh, Louis Anderson does not get
Louis
enough play.
Anderson, I know.
Okay, so this next one is... Okay, I can't even believe that this was actually a thing that almost happened, okay? The studio pitched for an African-American lead, but John Woo didn't think it was a great idea. seeing as Nicolas Cage was white.
Oh.
And his blackface may have given Troy's criminals a second thought as to his true identity.
You think at this point, probably not. They would have spun it like no, but like not even any difference. It's just like, oh, like everyone in the movie is just like,
about blackface.
Like, come on. I would just think you couldn't consider that for a role when people are switching faces.
As an option.
Like, yeah, like who even thought about that? Who even thought that up?
Yeah, and that John Woo had to be the one to be like, the director. I don't know if
that's a good idea.
That's going to work out.
It's not me that doesn't want it. It's his character that doesn't want it. Sorry, his character doesn't think this is a good idea. Like, how would that work at all? It's like Denzel Washington and Nicolas Cage switch faces.
It was so wild. I'm like,
I mean, at this point, it didn't really matter because nobody would have known. I mean, come on.
It's true. They would have figured something out.
They would have figured something out.
This is where it gets a little bit dicey, like not dicey, but convoluted in a way that I just was like, what the fuck? John Woo, okay, in the original script, he intended for Caster Troy and Sean Archer's characters to have been romantically involved, with Sean's unwillingness to let their love be known, acting as a catalyst for Caster's betrayal and subsequent murder of his son.
Wait, but the producers, gonna be a gay thing?
But the producers were worried that American audiences would be confused by that and find the characters less sympathetic.
What? What? So they were supposed to be like lovers that took each other's faces?
No, they were supposed to be lovers that had a falling out. And the falling out, because Sean Archer didn't want their love to be public, would have caused Caster Troy to go crazy and shoot his son. That was the impetus for that. Because remember how we were like, you never find out.
But B, like, first off, okay, if you break up with somebody, you don't kill their son. Okay, number one. But that is wild. Why? I mean, I would have loved to have seen that version.
I mean.
But then what would the catalyst for switching faces?
But yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. Like, I guess I'm also curious, like, was Sean in this version of the script that John Woo had, was Sean Archer still in the FBI? Was Caster Troy still a terrorist? Because that's also an interesting dynamic that they're like, like political and professional enemies, but then they're
attract.
Also
opposites attract. Love,
for sure.
Deep love knows no bounds.
Who does not want to watch a love scene with John Travolta and Nicolas Cage? Who doesn't?
Wearing each other's
that's
faces.
That's what I'm saying. In or a, yes, even better with them triangle. Having sex with each other as each other.
Would have been amazing. They really missed out on a huge audience for that movie.
Damn, they really missed an opportunity.
Opportunity.
There is a rumor. This isn't 100% sure, but there's a rumor that Paramount is going to do a sequel, and both John Travolta and Nicolas Cage are interested in returning.
What? No, I cannot. I cannot do a face-off too. There's no need for it. You can't do it in 2021. We're not that stupid anymore. We've grown. We've learned. We've learned from our mistakes. Can't make a face-off too.
I don't know.
I'm gonna squash that rumor. I'm getting online.
We've made some choices as a country that I don't know.
I know. Actually, a face-off 2 would be probably very well received right now.
So I'm not 100% sure. So, this one was a little weird. But I guess in the original version, it was called Birdman of Alcatraz in the Future.
Oh, wow. Okay. Cool name. Very
and
cool.
In it, you remember how, so there's that prison, right? And the yes. name of the prison, which you didn't catch this because I didn't catch it either, was the prison's name is Erewhon, which is an anagram of nowhere.
Oh, wow. Deep.
Number two.
Deep.
The prisoners with their boots. You know, they were like magnetic.
Oh, yeah. Like those giant magnet. They used those same boots in Battlefield Earth. They switched it over because that's part of the same costume. Anyway, I digress. What about it?
The prisoners used those boots to hang upside down from the ceiling. Wow. And they would collect the prisoners' bodily fluids. Don't 100% understand
Wait, what?
Anything about
what
that.
What is going on? What are you talking about?
The original script was mostly set in prison. In the prison. The writers called it Birdman of Alcatraz in the Future. In it, some prisoners hung upside down from the ceiling by their boots with IVs collecting bodily fluids.
That makes no sense.
Right.
I don't understand it. I'm confused by this whole statement.
I reject it.
I do have nothing to say about that. None of it makes sense. It is all gobbledygook to me right now.
It really 100% is. And also, they said that John Woo put real ex-criminals or ex-felons in the prison because he wanted it to feel real. Like, John Woo. John,
that's a little
people's
dangerous.
People's faces came off.
Yes.
Like, how real was this going to be?
Yeah. He also decided to have a giant movie screen put in the prison, too, so that they could watch the news.
Is that real,
so
John
that
Woo?
All the criminals could watch the news for some reason.
The thing, I didn't put this on the list. I thought I did, but I remembered it because it made me laugh so hard, was that John Woo would play really emotional, intense music to get them in the places they needed to be for the emotional
scenes. Get them hyped up, and then he gives them birthday cakes. And then he pops out of a birthday cake.
And then the stripper comes out.
The stripper comes out.
And John Travolta, he was like, you know what? I don't need this music. Like, I'm already there. This scene's already emotional.
Oh,
and I, for
so
the life of me, could not imagine or figure out a scene from that was like that emotional.
No, there was none.
Could you think of something that like they needed to have time to process?
Maybe his son dying at the beginning, I guess, you know, but that was like a quick 2 second thing.
Yeah.
I really was racking my brain. Yeah, there's no emotional scenes. The whole ending of the movie is just them fighting on a boat for like 45 minutes.
Yeah. They were also going to do that all green screen, but they also wanted to make it real. So
I'm glad they chose not to do green screen. That was a good choice. John Woo, you made one good choice with that movie.
Yeah, it was. There's just a lot. There was a lot going on. They took that movie incredibly seriously. I mean, there's even stuff in here about like the constellations. So main character's name is Sean Archer, Sagittarius the Archer. One of the constellations of the zodiac is diametrically opposed to the constellation Gemini, and Castor and Pollux are two
major
stars in the
Gemini constellation.
It's a movie
about two people's faces being switched, guys. Come on. Take it down a notch. You rip off each other's face flab skin and put it on another one. Come on. Slow your roll. Get off your high horse.
There's like a whole, there's a whole thing about why the guy who played Pollux played him the way he did in that bizarre way, because he watched a documentary about like a crazy genius.
Oh, yeah. That's why we said he made some bold choices with that acting, because the whole time you're like, is he crazy or is he supposed to not be crazy? Is he a genius? What's going on?
They had originally offered that part to Mark Wahlberg, and Mark Wahlberg's like, I don't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. Thank you very much.
Good choice, Mark Wahlberg. But later you did The Happening, so...
I mean,
and certain things you touch don't do it that great.
Well, if he touched me, I'd do great.
So stupid.
All right, moving on to Battlefield Earth.
Oh, Battlefield Earth. Love it.
All right.
Love Battlefield Earth.
I can't get over how much I love this movie, period. Just can't. Just want to say that off the top of my head. The amount of love I have for Battlefield Earth, it knows no bounds.
No bounds.
All right. So... number one, John Travolta initially offered the director's job to Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, wow. That would have been a very different movie. Very different movie. Everyone's just bloody for so long. Blood everywhere.
I mean, I would have definitely wanted to see it. It sounds interesting. And apparently, like, this is just a side note, but part of John Travolta's defense of this movie is that Quentin Tarantino was at the screening and that he loved it.
John Travolta, you're making that up. You made that up. Did Quentin Tarantino ever release a statement saying that he thought that was going to be a good movie?
Part of me is like, Kate, he did you a solid. He put you in Pulp Fiction. He brought you back into the zeitgeist. Maybe he's just a nice guy who's like, you did a great job, John.
Yeah, John,
great
this looks
job,
real
bud.
Good. Everyone wants to see a space movie that centers around office politics and corporate growth.
It's just so ahead of its time.
It was so ahead of its time. Everyone wants to see you drinking Kerbango, getting drunk on Kerbango, talking in a weird accent with your sixth finger. That sounds real good.
Oh, that reminds me. This is down the list, but I'll tell it to you now. Okay, apparently John Travolta was so inspired by Predator that he originally...
Yeah, like, the dreadlocks. That's why they all look like the Predator.
He originally delivered all of his lines in the Predator growl.
I don't even know what the Predator growl is. I've never seen Predator.
But you couldn't understand anything. So they had to go back and like loop a bunch of his sound, which made me laugh. Okay. Oh,
that just sounds so funny. Him walking around looking like the Predator because he kind of, if you see him, and then just him talking, I was creating galaxies at the Academy. I don't know how the Predator talks, but you get it.
So Barry Pepper, who plays Johnny Goodboy, he has tried to distance himself like... I mean, he's...
There's no way you can, bud.
Get there, that hair, galaxies your, away from yeah, this movie.
Your hair at the end of that movie, that little pony in the front. There's no way you're getting away from this.
If he could... What's that thing they do where they... I'm totally blinking now. Where they travel in and out of time. There's like the...
Teleport?
Transporter. Yes, the teleport. If he could teleport to the planet Cyclo to get away from this movie, he would do that.
What else is he in? Has he been in anything else?
Yeah, he is in a lot of stuff, actually. He was actually just in that movie, Colin, that we watched about the alligators that escaped during a hurricane.
Oh, Crawl.
Yeah, he was the dad.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I did not. Okay. So he's, well, he's getting on up there. He's making a movie about alligators. Actually, that movie was not that bad, but.
He's been in, like, some more movies, too. Like, I think it was, like, Band of Brothers or maybe Saving Private Ryan. It was, like, a World War II movie. So, he's like, he pops up in stuff pretty steadily.
Good. I'm glad. But because that movie probably set him back a little bit.
Oh, didn't do him any favors. And Forrest Whitaker, as well, has kind of disowned this and been like, yeah, I regret it. It was a mistake. Let's just move on. But Barry Pepper is... Everybody else is kind of, like... nice about it. You know, they're like, you know, it wasn't the best. I probably wouldn't do it again. Yeah. Barry Pepper's like, this was a terrible script. It had terrible production value. John Travolta's whole paycheck is where all the money went. The rest of us got fucked over. He's like, so he has...
Oh, good for him.
Yeah.
The whole movie's filmed sideways in lime green lighting.
Yeah. Oh, and the guy who does the lighting was saying, like, I had no budget. I had the like lowest budget I've ever had in my life. So I was trying to work with this just absolutely nothing. And so, yeah, there are some weird
choices. I just like, wonder what's going through the actor's head, like Forrest Whitaker, when he's listening to John Travolta, like in this ridiculous costume, in this ridiculous makeup, drinking Kerbango, and he's like yelling in this ridiculous voice. I wonder what's going through the actor's head, like, this is going to be a good movie.
Yeah.
Because John Travolta delivers his lines like, galaxy, like it's so campy and cheesy. Like you got to be sitting there thinking like, am I making the right choice?
Am I in the right place at the right time? Cyclos. And John Travolta is like a British Cyclo and Forrest Whitaker is not. Which also you have to be like, should we be on the same page about this?
You learn British accents at the Academy. That's it. Cyclone Academy.
We're both Cyclos. So do we both want to be British? Like, do we both want to be like, what's our choice here? Because we're both the same alien race. So there's not even consistency. Yeah,
it doesn't make sense
within that. So yes, again, we've said this before, but John Travolta referred to this film as either a Star Wars New Hope, but better, or the Schindler's List of science fiction films. Mm-hmm.
And he was right. He was right. So
and
that's it.
They're not a one person argued with them. All right. So John Travolta to this day has never, ever, ever admitted that this was a failure.
Because he can't. He takes himself way too seriously. He'll never be able to joke about it.
It's not that we think the movie is a failure. It's that the Cyclos actually didn't win the war. And so it's the man animals that feel like it was a success. But then inevitably the Cyclos failed because of that.
Yeah. If that's how you look at it, yeah.
They're just dancing around. No, you know, you didn't fail. That's how the story was. The Cyclos failed. So he keeps
those
defending
damn writers.
It, and he's like, so this is what he says. Not every film can be a critical and box office success. It would have been awful only if Battlefield Earth was neither, and that's just not the case. It's edging toward $100 million, which means it has found an audience, even if the critics didn't like it.
Yeah, I found an audience with people making fun of it, John Travolta. That's the only reason people are watching it, is to make fun of how ridiculously stupid that movie was.
And he's also now his go-to line is like, everybody is prejudiced against Scientology. Everybody thought it was about Scientology, so they shut it down.
JT, look at the facts, bud. You made a really shit movie.
How dare you?
I mean, a really good, good transformative movie.
Back when the book was first written, John Travolta wanted to make a movie of it from the beginning, like back in the 80s, and stars Johnny Goodboy, of course, because he wanted to be the hero. But he couldn't get any investors back in the day, especially because it was associated with Scientology. So by the time it got made, he was too old.
Oh,
so he's like, I guess I'll play Turl.
Oh, yeah. He wanted that to get made for so long. He loved it. It was on his his life goal to get that movie made.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. He took a huge pay cut, even though Barry Pepper's like all the money went to him. He still took a massive pay cut in order to make it. He's like, because he made a deal like, kind of like Mel Gibson did when he made The Passion of the Christ, where he's like, I'll put my own money into this. And then whatever we make in revenue, like, I'll just take a percentage out of that if it does well, thinking that he was going to just like rake it in. But that did not work in his favor.
Poor guy.
So he took a pay cut and didn't really make anything off the back end either. John Travolta and Kelly Preston wrote her cameo themselves. I don't know.
Wow. I did not guess that. Oh, did you remember also one thing I wanted to mention is Cyclos don't just have a sixth finger. They have a really long tongue. Because at the end, when she's bribing him, she like licks him and her tongue comes out. And it's like 10 inches long.
It's supposed to be like super sexual or something, but it's
her beautiful forehead. Because women cyclones only just have giant foreheads with Dracula hairlines.
That's what makes them so sexual. But speaking of the numbers of fingers, there's continuity errors all over the place in some scenes. He has five and some he has six.
What? No way. Color me surprised.
While trying to get a major studio to produce the project, John Travolta called Battlefield Earth the equivalent to Pulp Fiction from the year 3000. So it makes sense that he would ask Tarantino.
That was all Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction had
no, all over the place.
How can it be Schindler's List in space?
Pulp Fiction and Star Wars all at once. How can it be all of
those?
He's
just hitting all his bases. He's just hitting every audience he can.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And this also blew my mind. Okay, so the book is 1,000 pages. And the film only covers the first 400 pages of the book. So
what,
there was supposed
more?
To be...
Yes, I got to get my hands on that book. I've got to see what the cyclos do.
And the second half is Johnny Goodboy, the hero, restoring Earth to its former glory by using all of their mind gold to pay off planet Earth's debts.
Oh,
also,
my God.
By
oh
rehabilitating
God.
And surviving the cyclos.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, my God. I'm going to read that. I have to read it. I got to figure out what's up, Johnny Goodboy. It's just 1,000 pages of just listening to him mining gold, paying back debts, getting the office back in order, rehiring people.
For every day, they get mine X amount of gold, and they owe this much to the universe.
Well, now he's got to create a business so that he can pay off his debt.
Oh, now we get to learn all about being an entrepreneur.
Yeah, so now we just repeat the cycle.
Yeah, so I was just like, part of me is sad that there wasn't a Battlefield Earth 2 because that was always the plan, was to do a sequel. And, oh man, I'm kind of bummed that it didn't happen because it was the gift that kept on giving
yet.
The first
didn't
time around.
Yet,
you're right. And despite the Church of Scientology declaring multiple times that Battlefield Earth had nothing to do with their faith, there have been lots of people who are like higher ups in the organization that have left, like Mike Rinder and Marty Rathbun, who are both like, I don't know if you do Scientology in the aftermath, but I am obsessed with that. And I love Mike Rinder so much. So anyway, he was super high up in Scientology leadership. And he's like, no, he absolutely played a vital role. Like David Miscavige was part of the everyday footage of the film. He would watch all of the playback daily and he would give them advice and make creative suggestions.
Okay. And that's the guy from, he's like the head of Scientology or something?
Yes. He's like their prophet. He's like super high up.
Oh,
and after,
okay. So just casually on the set, just being like, this has nothing to do with Scientology, but
right.
You should add this aspect that I got just out of my brain.
100%. Even the writer, this, I didn't put this on the list, but something that was interesting was that the original writer of the script, his name was J.D. Shapiro, and he met like the connections for this movie because someone was trying to convert him to Scientology. He was hanging out in the Scientology Center. Oh, and
they used to get me back in the day in Hawaii. They would always be like, are you stressed? And I'm like, of course I'm stressed.
Of course,
come take a stress test. And I'm like, okay. And I take it. And they're like, you're really stressed. And I'm like, what do I need to do? And they're like,
but like, hold
Scientology.
These cams.
Yes. And then I'd be like, oh God, you got me again. Every time they tricked me. Every time I...
multiple times.
It was, I know, like, I was done. Always just, they get you with all these things, and then they're like, have you heard about Scientology? And I'm like, yes, and I have nothing against it, but you told me this was a stress test. I don't think Scientology is going to make me less stressed.
You were doing medical trials and you weren't just
I don't know.
Being tested by Scientology?
Maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
So, I mean, he was a part of it, and our J.D. Serpiro was trying to be converted. He said no. But they were like, I mean, since we've got you here, like, would you write this movie for us? Like, we've been looking for a screenwriter. So he says yes, but he maintains that he was very clearly like, I don't want to be a Scientologist. I have no interest in this. I will write this movie for you, but only because it sounds interesting. And then
that's a lie. That movie sounded interesting.
They gave it to somebody else after he was done. And I guess where it's at now, or what became of it, was because somebody rewrote it. And he's like, I literally tried to get my name taken off the credits. Like, it was so bad that after I passed on it, or like after I did my draft and they rewrote it, I was like, I don't even want to get paid for this. Ooh, I don't even want my credits on it. Nothing. And his managers were like, listen, contractually, like, you have to do this, and da 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 da. You were paid a certain amount of money for it. And so he had to leave his name on it, but he was like, he hated that he did. And he's like, sometimes I think I should be proud that, like, of all the shitty movies, like, mine was the shittiest.
Maybe yeah, there's take like ownership. Something to be said take for ownership. That. Take ownership. Just make it empower you. Let it empower you.
And it was inherently, like, really impractical in a lot of ways. Like, they were walking on 4-foot stilts, like those boots.
Yes, those Hot Topic boots.
Just, yeah.
I'm telling you, they took them from the Face Off set.
It was nuts. So, anyway, the point is that after the film didn't do well, David Miscavige reportedly just completely threw Travolta under the bus. And was like, it sucks because of him.
Sorry.
And he took too much of a salary. It sabotaged everything else. He kind of hopped on the Barry Pepper train. And so everybody is kind of throwing him under the bus. At the same time, he's like, oh, there's not even a bus, guys. I don't throw me wherever you want, but there's no bus coming. It was a great movie. I made a ton of money.
The money bus. So he could throw me under the money bus.
Yeah, you could throw me under the money bus. I'll take that. But he, to this day, is like, oh, I would make it all over again. I have no regrets about it. I love it. I would make a sequel in a heartbeat. And yeah, so he stands by it to this day. Good for him.
Whatever. Well, those are some fascinating facts about bad movies.
I mean,
some more fascinating than others.
The takeaway for me was Hollywood parrots exist.
Yeah, that's the big takeaway for me, that Hollywood parrots exist, and that that actually probably was the big takeaway. I love that. I love that. Who knew that there were Hollywood parrots? You learn something every day.
I just want to see parrots with little sunglasses on.
The fan fiction, or the theories behind Deep Blue Sea, that was so ridiculous. Like, they just really went for it.
Ugh. Love it.
Well, anyway, we just wanted to share a little bit of, knowledge about these great movies that we watch. I know you guys are super interested.
Just give you some context, guys.
I know you
just
guys really are fascinated.
Fully flesh out.
I know. In case there's any questions, we have to let you know these facts. But we'll see you next week for another episode.
Enjoy. In the meantime.
Enjoy. In the meantime. Thanks for sticking in.
I don't even know what I was going to say. Either. Enjoy. Bye. Just enjoy your life.
Just enjoy your life. Enjoy your life. Bye.
Bye.
Hi, editor here. I just found out that you can read the entire Battlefield Earth book online for free. And so I was just kind of skimming through it, and I realized that I just want to read to you guys the first, little bit of the first page, because the way that Mr. Hubbard writes is comparable to like a 14-year-old writing fan fiction. It's very good. Man, said Turl, is an endangered species. The hairy paws of the Chamco brothers hung suspended above the broad keys of the laser bash game. The cliffs of Char's eye bones drew down over his yellow orbs as he looked up in mystery. Even the steward, who had been padding quietly about picking up saucepans, lumbered to a halt and stared. Turl could not have produced a more profound effect had he thrown a meat girl naked into the middle of the room. The clear dome of the Intergalactic Mining Company Employee Recreation Hall shone black around and above them, silvered at its crossbars by the pale glow of the Earth's single moon, half full on this late summer night. Turl lifted his large amber eyes from the tome that rested minutely in his massive claws and looked around the room. He was suddenly aware of the effect he had produced, and it amused him. Anything to relieve the humdrum monotony of a 10-year duty tour in this god's abandoned mining camp way out here on the edge of a minor galaxy. In an even more professorial voice, already deep and roaring enough, Turl repeated his thought. Man is an endangered species. Char glowered at him. What in the name of disease crap are you reading? Turl did not much care for his tone. After all, Char was simply one of several mine managers, but he, Turl, was chief of mine site security. I didn't read it. I thought it. You must have got it from somewhere, growled Char. What is that book? Turl held it up so Char could see its back. It said General Report of Geological Mine Sites, Volume 250,369. Like all such books, it was huge, but printed on material that made it almost weightless, particularly on a low-gravity planet such as Earth, a triumph of design and manufacture that did not cut heavily into the payloads of freighters.
Anyways, this book is a masterpiece, and I just wanted to come in and say that.